Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. And it's a good job that there's no set schedule, because if there was, I would, by any metric, be falling well behind. Life is a bit crazy at the moment. I'm doing lots of different stuff, traveling lots, got a new girlfriend, all these different kind of things. And reading and podcasting is sort of suffering a bit with all these other projects that I'm doing at the same time. I hope you don't mind. I added a bonus show to the feed, which was me talking to Rim and Scott from a different podcast about something almost entirely disconnected with science fiction. But it seemed to get quite a bit of quite a bit of interesting feedback, so hopefully people didn't mind that. And thanks a lot for all emails that people have sent me. Again, not just podcasting and stuff, and also replying to emails. However, if you do send me an email to luke@juggler.net, I do reply to every single email that I receive, which is, you know, sometimes a few a day, but I do try and get to every single one of them and do it. So at the moment, I'm on a cruise ship sailing somewhere around the south of Greece, and the sea is very rough at the moment. I'm a little bit seasick, so don't mind me if I'm pausing to have a drink and to vomit. No, I'm not vomiting. Not that bad. But it's a bit of a rough sea at the moment. And what else is going on? Oh, yes, of course. It's November, which means I'm doing, yet again, the National Novel Writing Month, the NaNoWriMo. And I'm writing the third part in a three-part series or three-part collection of works, which started 2 years ago when I did the NaNoWriMo. 2 years ago, I did wrote a book called Minding Tomorrow, and last year I also wrote a book called Combat, and they're both of the same setting, and now I'm doing Minding Tomorrow Part 3, or the third book in this series. So far, it's going really good, although I was at a juggling convention this past weekend, and that sort of set me back a bit in the word count, but I'm going to catch up with it. Like I say, I'm on a cruise ship now, I've probably got a bit more time on my hands, and hopefully people will be able to, I'll put that out, and people will be able to read it, and read the conclusion, or the concluding section to this these novels that I've been writing recently over the past few years. Anyway, let's get on to the novel that I'm going to be reviewing here. It's called Slaughterhouse-Five, the Children's Crusade, and it's written by Kurt Vonnegut, and it's written back in 1969. Now, this is one of the most recommended books for me to read, and it always comes with this warning. They say, oh yeah, there's aliens and time travel, but it really isn't about those things. It's not quite science fiction. I was really, I was always a bit sort of intrigued by this. I'd actually read one, I think I've read one Kurt Vonnegut novel before. I think it was the Galapagos novel, and quite enjoyed it, but it was years ago, and I never really got round to reading these other books of his, even though they're considered to be, you know, classics of American literary fiction and things like that. I don't know why I never got round to it, but I finally did, and it got to the point where I was getting so many recommendations, and then someone said, why don't you just read this? And I looked on Audible, and I thought, fuck it, I'm just going to download it, and so I did. Now, there's two ways that I can talk about this book. One of them is slightly spoilerific, and the other one is a bit too much sort of surface level. One is like, let me put it this way, the surface level one is like, if you're reading the book and maybe you didn't understand it, I'll get to why I'm talking in these terms a bit later. You know, there's a technique going on there, there's obviously a story going on below the surface of the story that you've missed, and you can look at the story in that level and that in that way and just take it for what's written there. Yet, after I read the book and actually going through to the end of the book, there is a point in the book where all the questions are answered and all the different things that are going on and all the puzzles about the book are solved, or not all of them, but some of them are solved about it. However, if I talk about the book in that way, I'm sure I'm going to spoil it a bit, but due to something I'm going to do later on in the review, which I don't normally do, I think I am probably going to spoil this book. However, it's also in some ways a difficult book to spoil because of the way it's written. You know what happens at the end of the book, at the beginning of the book, you know how it's going to end. It even says that right at the beginning. So I'll get onto that in a second. First of all, the setting of the book. A lot of it takes place in Germany during the Second World War. Starts in Luxembourg there, and our main character and the narrator travel by train across to Dresden after surrendering at the Battle of the Bulge. And then there's also parts of the story told in the USA in a place called Ilium in New York, where the main character lives after the end of the Second World War. And also there is, of course, the alien abduction part as well. So there's this foreign, not foreign, this alien planet, you know, millions of light years away called Tralfamador, and where the Tralfamadorians live. And our main character, Billy Pilgrim, is abducted and taken there as well. So we've got these different settings. I think they're very well described. Of course, Kurt Vonnegut knows the United States and sort of like suburbia very, very well, or rural United States and New York and stuff like that very, very well. So I really enjoyed that section. And of course, the whole train ride across Germany and his, you know, and them being in Dresden during the firebombing of Dresden at the end of the Second World War. Again, that's all very, very impressively described, even though the language, even though the writing is very minimalist and very sparse. Kurt Vonnegut could really sum up quite a lot of things, and all these characters and all these events and all these different things that are taking place. He just says it in like a few lines. And in those few lines, he can somehow, you know, convey very poetically and in just a few clever turns of phrase, he can put across these settings really well. So I really enjoyed the settings of this book, even though, like I say, it's described very sparsely throughout as well. Getting onto the story, so, like I say, two ways that you can look at this story. I'm just going to summarise the first way. The story is quite interesting because the plotting is told very non-linearly. It's a very non-linear story. And it's told from the point of view of Billy Pilgrim. And he is a guy who has become unstuck in time, is, I guess, the classic way to look at this. I think that's mentioned as well in the book many times, that he's become unstuck in time. He can travel throughout time, so that his story isn't told, I did this, and then I did this, and then I did this, but you're like, first I was here in Dresden, and then I was over here, and then I was back in Germany, and things like that. So Billy Pilgrim is a guy who is caught up in the war, but he doesn't really know what he's doing there. He's not a soldier. He's actually just an assistant for the cleric, not the cleric, for the clergy in the. What am I trying to say? What's the name of the chaplain? That's what I'm saying. He's a chaplain's assistant in the Second World War. So he doesn't have a gun. He doesn't have any of the gear. He's just dropped into the battle, and then he's moved here, moved there. And in the end, he ends up surrendering to the Germans and is taken on a train as a prisoner of war across Germany. And he meets along the way lots of interesting characters and things like that. And that part of the story is told in quite a linear fashion, but is mixed up with lots of different kind of things that happen after he gets back from the war and is trying to live with his experiences of being, you know, stuck in a meat locker underneath a slaughterhouse number 5 in Dresden, in the cool like freezer underneath a slaughterhouse. And while Dresden burns above him, he is stuck down there, and he gets out. And he, you know, he sees Dresden after the firebombing, and he goes into the corpse mines where they dig down into the air raid shelters, which have been burnt out. Although they've not been burnt out, the people down inside the air raid shelters, all the oxygen was burnt out of the air, so everyone just suffocated there. Even though down below the heat wasn't what killed them, it was all these other kind of things. So this is, you know, is all, like I say, told linearly, but then linear, I can't even say that word, which is really bad for a non-linear novel that I'm reviewing here. So yeah, he goes backwards and forwards between this story into different parts of his life. You know, we found out about his wedding and what happens after his wedding and his children, and also about his abduction by aliens and his trip to Tralfamador. And again, these different kind of things are referenced all the way through. And in the end, we find out about the death of his wife, and you know. But the good thing is about all these different things that you're going backwards and forwards to is all laid out at the beginning of the book. Kurt Vonnegut, the narrator character, anyway, he says, "Oh, this is what Billy Pilgrim, our main character, did. He did this, 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 and this, and this." So when we're going backwards and forwards through time, telling things from his point of view, you're not going to be confused because you've already got this roadmap about what's going to happen throughout this book and what's going to happen at the end of the book. So that's what we get really here. That's the main plot. However, at this second level, as you can see after reading it, you go, so actually what did happen here? This is what happens in Billy Pilgrim's head. This is how he has subjectively experienced this whole all these events, how he goes backwards and forwards through time. But there's this question, did this really happen and did it not happen? And of course there is this plot going on as well of actually what's going on with Billy's mind, which is sort of like this level on top of what's going on there. And at the end of the novel there's these events that happen, you go, why are we spending so much time, why is Billy going into this pawn shop in Times Square and why is he doing this and why are we finding out so much about the, why are we hearing so much? And you realize actually the conclusion of the novel in the plot wise in this non-linear plotting actually answers all the questions to what's going on. And I don't really want to give that too much of that away, but it is all there, that there is actually a very, very clear plot structure going on subjectively with Billy Pilgrim, and there's a very, very clear plot going on objectively with Billy Pilgrim as well, told from the point of view of the narrator. Now, the narrator is Kurt Vonnegut. However, you think, well, this is a fictional novel telling non-fictional events, like I say, the prisoner of war experience in Germany, life in New York, like small town, upstate New York as well, and also, you know, the whole firebombing of Dresden and things like that too. So all that's going on, and the narrator is referenced throughout, even the whole first chapter, which is actually one of my favourite parts of the book, is where, you know, Kurt Vonnegut, or the character of the narrator, is going, oh, this has all really happened to me and things like that, and I want to write my great novel about the firebombing of Dresden, because I was there, and I'm a novelist, and I should be able to write this novel about it. And I'm not quite sure actually how much of that first part is fiction or real, or if it was based on, you know, real events. I'm not entirely sure, and to be honest, it doesn't really matter, but it is sort of like a fiction about writing fiction and the reasons to write it. And of course the narrator character does pop up throughout the book as well. He's saying, oh, when Billy Pilgrim, he saw this guy there, and that was me. And then he goes, oh, and I called up Billy Pilgrim by accident, you know, I got the wrong number, and that was me. And also I was one of the guys who went into the corpse mines in Dresden afterwards, like that. Actually, talking about Dresden, I actually went to Dresden for the first time back in 2002. I went there and was working at this conference, and I was working for God TV at the time, and I was down there filming a big Christian conference. And it was amazing, actually. I didn't realize, I mean, I knew about the firebombing of Dresden, and I knew a bit about this and that, and I knew about the reasons why it was done. But it was actually when I went there for the first time, and I was seeing these speakers talking about, you know, nominally Christian things and things, but also they were talking about a lot about forgiveness and about forgiving the British and forgiving the Americans about the firebombing of Dresden. Now this was in 2002, which is, you know, quite a few years, like what, 57 years after the firebombing of Dresden. And of course it was still a massive part of the city identity and the mindset of the people there, this firebombing and this like completely unjustified bombing of their city and the complete destruction of the city centre is, you know, one of those things that is still, like I say, a massive part of the city, and people there still, it's still on their minds a lot, you know, it's not gone away. And I went there again a few years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, because when I went there in 2002, I didn't really see much of the city. I didn't, you know, because, you know, a lot of it's been rebuilt, and like the different churches have been rebuilt, and this and that's been rebuilt, and some of it survived, and there's things like that. And then I actually went back just as a tourist again, and didn't really meet any of the locals, but actually saw that, you know, the city centre, and you know, as a tourist as well. So it's a bit strange to see Dresden in that way. And of course you can see what Kurt Vonnegut, why he wants to write about it, because it is like a massive part of his life and a massive part of the history of the Second World War. Well, it's actually a very minor part, but a very big part, because, you know, it's estimated that, you know, as many people died in these firebombings. Actually, in Japan, it says very clearly that in some firebombings in Japan, the firebombings, the incendiary bombs, killed more people than the atomic bombs. And while I'm not sure about the latest figures about Dresden that have come out, you know, still 50,000 people dying in a single night, whatever the figure is, it's sort of like in the tens of thousands, you know, between, you know, 20 and, say, 50,000. I'm not entirely sure, like I say. The numbers that the narrator, or Billy Pilgrim, all these other characters that she quote about how many people died in Dresden, I think they're sort of slightly overestimated, like above, like up to 125,000 people died in a single night. However, there's a lot to write about if you've lived through, if you're actually there and you lived through that experience. So yeah, we get this sort of this chapter one, this preamble, this prologue about the writing of the book. And it's quite interesting. He says, yeah, and this is going to be the final chapter, and the final section is going to be this one guy who, after living through the firebombing of Dresden, a small group of prisoners of war and our guards were the only ones to live through it and the only ones to come out of the city centre alive. And then one of us was convicted of looting one of the buildings that had been spared, or one of the parts of the Dresden that had been spared. He'd stole a teapot, and because of that, he was killed by a firing squad. And you're like, what? And that's a great ending to the book. And of course, by the time you get to it, it's not really a spoiler because you see it coming all the way through. It's been dropped in. It's like, oh yeah, and this was the guy who was killed by the firing squad. This is the main character. This is the final incident that's going to wrap up the end of the book. However, we spend a lot more time with Billy Pilgrim in a pawn shop in Times Square in London, and yet this main thing that the narrator is saying, this is what the book's going to be about, this is going to be the ironic twist at the ending, that this guy who lived through the firebombing is then killed by a firing squad for stealing a teapot, that is literally done away with three lines at the end. It's like, oh yeah, and then he stole the teapot and was shot for it. And it isn't even commented at the end, because the rest of the book has been commenting about this different kind of stuff. So the narrator is one main character. Of course, Billy Pilgrim, who looks like a filthy flamingo, is one of the descriptions, of him. He's this guy, like I say, he doesn't know what he's doing in the war. He's completely... he's completely dumbfounded by the war. He doesn't know what's going on, completely lost. He's just like this completely passive guy going through. He doesn't know what's going on at all. And it's a very strange kind of journey that he goes on, which I'll talk a bit more about in a bit. But you do have all these other really quite fun characters, all, I would say, completely one-dimensional, but I think intentionally one-dimensional. You've got the Kilgore Trout, who's a science fiction author. You've got these other soldiers who are with Billy Pilgrim. Of course, the narrator is with Billy Pilgrim as he goes through as well. But you've got these the British. I really enjoyed when they go to this prisoner of war camp, which is all Russians except the British officers in the middle, and they've accidentally been sent too much food and are doing really well out of the war, but they've been there for 4 years and haven't seen anyone, haven't seen any women or any children or any birds or anything for 4 or 5 years since the beginning of the Second World War. And you get these other two characters. One of them is Roland Weary, who is as useless as Billy Pilgrim himself, but he's sort of got these delusions of grandeur and how great he is. He's got this knife, and he's a really great guy with his knife. But then when you actually see these scouts who Roland Weary and Billy Pilgrim are with, you realize actually they don't have to have delusions of grandeur, because they're actually quite good at what they're doing. And actually at the end of the novel, at the end of the audiobook that I listened to, Kurt Vonnegut is actually, there's a little like 10-minute interview with him, and he says, no, I was never Billy Pilgrim, I was a scout. And you realize actually he was one of the scouts. Of course, the scouts at the beginning of the book don't make it through to the end of the book, but you understand that Kurt Vonnegut is definitely not the character of Roland Weary, or of course Billy Pilgrim himself. And then you get later on, you get this other character who's got delusions of grandeur called Paul Lazaro, I think his name is, and he has got these he's got this obsession of grandeur as well. However, his grandeur is actually played out in the mind of Billy Pilgrim. He probably is as useless as Roland Weary, because Roland Weary dies and he blames Billy for dying, and Paul Lazaro says, I'm going to take revenge on Billy Pilgrim, and I'm gonna kill him later on. I'm not going to do it now, but later on, when we get back to New York, or when we get back to America, I can have anyone killed. He says, I can have anyone killed for $1,000 plus, plus expenses or something like that. So you get these really interesting characters there, who again are almost projections of Billy Pilgrim, or the way that Billy Pilgrim sees these other people. It's like, oh, this is their function in my life. This is this guy's function. This is my wife. She is fat, but she is rich. And this is my daughter, she is a bit bitchy, but you know, she's got to do this, and then she's like this. And this is my son, he is this, he is this, he is this. And it's interesting that Billy Pilgrim, by the way that he views life, and in his sort of like addled brain, he only sees these other people as fulfilling one role in his life. Like, this is the American Nazi, and this is what he does, and then we did this, and this is his point in the story, and then we can move on. So they've actually got quite a large cast of different characters whose job it is to fulfill like a single role in Billy Pilgrim's life. I guess if this book was written differently, you could probably have like Billy Pilgrim plus two other characters, and all the, if they were all more well-rounded, you would do this. But it's very difficult to do that when a book is told in a non-linear fashion, and you're skipping from one person to another, one event to another. You need these different people at different parts, and a lot of them, of course, have to die in this book. So lots of good stuff here as well with these different characters. Moving on to, what do I do next here on my review? Science fiction elements. What is there? Well, of course, the time travel that's going on in this book is an interesting way of doing it. It's completely subjective. So Billy Pilgrim doesn't actually travel through time, but his subconscious does, or his conscious mind travels through time, but he doesn't have any conscious control over it. So he goes here and he goes there, and he just finds himself at different points in his life. So he always knows at any point in his life what's happening later and how he dies and when he's going to get abducted by aliens, things like that, and that he's going to live through the war. So he doesn't really mind about, you know, anything going on in the Second World War, because he's already lived, he's already experienced his life after the Second World War, and he knows he's going to get married, he knows what he's going to do for a job, he's going to make, you know, glasses for a living, an optometrist, and you know, so he knows all about this. So it's a very strange form of time travel, and the way it's seen is through the eyes of the aliens. So he gets, at one point, he gets abducted by aliens, and these aliens are the Tralfamadorians, and it's quite an interesting take on an alien abduction, because it is pure pulp science fiction ideas here as well, which again I'll get onto in a second, but it's like pure wish fulfillment is one of those things that is sort of criticized about science fiction, I guess, by Kurt Vonnegut and by the character of Kilgore Trout, who is this science fiction. So what's actually said about Kilgore Trout is that his science fiction ideas are amazing, but his writing is terrible. And I think this book has these sort of ideas or these tropes of science fiction within the book, time travel and alien abduction and, you know, different views on time. But it's saying that if this was a science fiction book, it wouldn't be any good, or there'd be no reason for me to write it in this literary style with this, you know, with this beautiful language and things like this. But what I want to do is use the ideas of science fiction rather than actually it being science fiction. So, and this is an amazing thing, just at one point, one of the most profound sections of this book, for me, and I found out, of course, for other people as well, is that it goes, Billy Pilgrim went downstairs, and because he'd been travelling through time, he knew this was the night of his daughter's wedding. This is the night where he would be picked up by the aliens and taken to the Tralfamador, but he had to wait a few hours, so he watched a movie. And then he watched, because he was slipped in time, he also watched the movie backwards, and then he watched it forwards again. He says he liked watching it backwards the best. Because then it goes on to this really, really beautiful passage about this story told in reverse. It's sort of like seen going backwards through time. This is how Billy Pilgrim saw the story of these bomber pilots, American bomber pilots, in the Second World War. And it talks about, you know, broken down planes taking off from England, flying backwards over to Germany, you know, German planes coming up and sucking bullets out of the people and out of the planes, and some of the planes joining them, more American planes, like, taking off immediately, you know, out of fireballs from Germany. It tells her this thing about the view of what war would look like, or bombings would look like, if you watch them backwards, about, you know, fire from the ground suddenly springing into these small containers, being travelled up and then being locked away inside, you know, safely inside inside planes, and then these planes start going back, and then the bombs being sent back to America, and then being dismantled by women, and all the dangerous ingredients being put back into the ground, where they'll never again sort of damage anyone. And it's just an amazing segment, and I think this is great. The idea of science fiction, the idea of time travel, you can look at war, you can look at life in different ways, which you couldn't do without these science fiction ideas. And this is why I think you get so many of these different TV shows, and they're taking the ideas of science fiction, and they're not science fiction. There's nothing science fiction about them except one simple idea. I remember my mother used to watch this this TV show, this pretty crappy TV show called Early Edition, and it was about a guy who got tomorrow's newspaper today, and so he would always know what was going to happen in the newspaper the next day, and he would go around and save the people falling off the bridges and putting out the fires, you know, before they spread and burnt down the whole buildings. And it was, you know, there was only one, like, fantasy kind of science fiction idea about it, which was learning the future today and then what you need to do to go about sorting that out. And there was this whole other human aspect to it there, but you could never really call it science fiction, or most people wouldn't call it science fiction, because there was only one trope, and that was sort of like this slight time slip about this information coming back through time and informing someone about things before they happened. And like I say, the idea of science fiction was good, but that wouldn't normally be enough, like, to bring people in, because normally a science fiction TV show, you'd normally think about something like you know, Star Trek, and people go, oh, I don't want to do science fiction because, you know, there's aliens and it's all stupid like that. But then these other things which are, you know, so appealing to, like, even people like my mother, who would never really bother too much about science fiction, but she really liked these other kind of ideas. Anyway, I talked about this watching a World War II movie backwards, and of course I found it very effective and very touching, and I was sort of like laughing, had tears in my eyes as well at the same time, because it's so moving for me to read this kind of new take, or not new take, but like a twisted take on what war could look like, or what war could be. But again, it can't actually be that. So I was sort of like, had tears of joy and tears of sadness both at the same time. And then at the end of the audiobook, after this small interview with Kurt Vonnegut about Slaughterhouse-Five and about him writing it, you know, it was an interview maybe 20 years later or something like that, then they actually had this extract, I think it might have been from the film or a reading of Kurt Vonnegut reading this same section again afterwards, but put to some more emotionally music, like emotionally heartstring dragging kind of music as well, over the top of it, or like layered underneath it as well. So maybe I'll include that at the end of this podcast. I probably shouldn't, because like I say, it's probably copyrighted or something like that, but it is a very, very touching section. So I understand now why that was the single section from this whole book. It was the section which jumped out to me most about it, or the most concise view of using a science fiction idea to talk about war and to talk about life and to talk about death. And again, there's a reason why someone else included this at the end of this. So on to the writing. Oh, there's lots of difference. I talked a bit about the writing as well. Not a lot of description, and yet what description there is like very beautiful and poetic. Like I say, very minimal. There's this phrase which is repeated over and over throughout the novel, which is, and so it goes, or so it goes. And it's repeated every time death is mentioned, every time mortality is mentioned. But not just, it's not just like any time one person dies it's mentioned, but like 10,000 people die, and then he just writes, and so it goes. And then there's a rat dies, and so it goes. And some bacteria dies, and so it goes. And then Jesus dies, and it just goes, and so it goes, or so it goes. And while I understand why some people would get annoyed about this constant repeating of it, I think it was really, it became a game, really, as well. Like, every time death, like I say, was mentioned, I was thinking, okay, he's going to say, and so it goes. And Ethan Hawke was the narrator here of the Audible, I think the Blackstone audio production of this, audiobook production of this. And he would just, you know, every time it would come along, and then I'd say, and so it goes, and then Ethan Hawke would go, and so it goes. But he would say it in a different way each time. So I understand if you're actually reading this book, like, on the page, it would be maybe a bit annoying. But because it was being read to me, and Ethan Hawke, the narrator, put a different inflection on it every time, or a different pause before saying it each time, it became a performance, it became a game. And I was like, okay, well, how is Ethan Hawke going to take, how is his take going to be on this mention of death? And you can sort of see it by the way he says, and so it goes. And it really does bring a lot of attention to, like, one of the main themes of this book, which I'll get into in a minute. But of course, the narration, I thought, by Ethan Hawke was very, very good. He says it all, it's very monotone, it's very quiet, it's very, you know, like pondering. It's just like, yes, he does this and this and this, and does this and this and this, which is a very interesting way of like doing it, because it's such a minimalist book. It's very short. It's only maybe, what, less than 200 pages long. It only takes like 5 hours to listen to the whole thing. So I think his reading really did sum up what it was, you know, what you actually needed from this book. And he's an American author, to like reading an American book, which I think is very important, especially because the audiobook that I'm listening to at the moment. But I'll get onto that on the next episode as well. But yeah, I think, you know, 5 stars for Ethan Hawke and his narration. I was really unsure how it was going to be, but I really am very, very impressed by the reading there as well. So, getting onto the themes of this book. Now, there's lots of themes here, and I was just chatting just last night. I just mentioned to Jesse Willis from the SFF Audio podcast. I was just chatting to him, and I said, well, I finished it, but I've got to do the review because I finished this book on Saturday, but I've been busy these last few days of traveling and things. And I'm not quite sure what to write about it. You know, I'm not quite sure what to not write about it. I'm not quite sure what to say about it because, you know, it's very profound. It's affected me in lots of ways. It's got lots of big ideas in it. I'm not quite sure what to say. I can't really sum up my ideas or sum up my views about this. And so Jesse said, well, why don't you just read some of the reviews? I said, no, I don't like doing that. You know, I hate reading reviews before I do my own review. He says, no, maybe in this case it'll help. So what I did, I went onto Amazon.com. And I clicked and I looked up some of the different reviews that people had done. I looked at some 1-star reviews and 2 stars and all the way up through the sort of 5-star reviews. And that's when I realized actually why I hate reading other people's reviews before I do my own review, because all these ideas were in my head. But I think this time it did help a little bit because it did sort of focus about what other people think about this and why I need to talk about why this book is just so awesome. Because it just makes me angry about how many people just missed the whole point of the book. For example, I read this 1-star review. I'm not going to credit this because this person is obviously an idiot. It says, it's never clear whether the reader is to believe that Billy can actually time travel or whether he's completely out of his mind. Well, it is very clear if he can actually time travel or whether he is completely out of his mind. It's because, for a start, this book is not a science fiction book. And I've said this before, it uses the ideas of science fiction to talk about different things, but it's not a science fiction book. And it's quite clear about that at the beginning when, of course, the narrator character is saying, I'm going to write this book and do this, and it's going to be about this and this and this. And because he's actually writing in a non-science fiction world, then he starts talking about Billy Pilgrim's, and what he's going to experience and the way that he saw it. He says, I'm not going to talk about it from my point of view. I'm going to talk about it from the point of view of Billy Pilgrim. Now, there's nothing in that earlier section to say that this is a science fiction book. He doesn't say Billy Pilgrim was abducted by aliens. He says he thinks he was abducted by aliens. He says he was abducted by aliens. So now I'm going to get into a little bit of spoiler territory here. But however, I don't think it's going to be too much of a spoiler because, again, this is very clear from the beginning. So it says, this person again, it says, it's never clear whether the reader is to believe that Billy can actually time travel or whether he is completely out of his mind. And someone else is saying, yeah, am I meant to believe that he is abducted by aliens? It's like, no, you're not. Read the book again. If you can't read it, if you can't understand this in your first reading, you need to read the book again because you're obviously an idiot. There's a very, very clear moment in Billy Pilgrim's life where we know that this novel, where we know this point of, let me put it this way. We know at what point in Billy Pilgrim's life his mind is at, when he is telling this story or when the narrator character is taking this story out of Billy Pilgrim's mind and writing it down. And we know what that point of the book is. It's because that's what the narrator tells us at the beginning. Is like, it's taken me this long to write it. It's taken me here. And now I'm going to write it. But I'm going to write it from Billy Pilgrim's point of view. And we're writing it from there. So everything that happened before that is from Billy Pilgrim's point of view. And I'll give you a clue where it comes up at the book as well. It's at the end of the book. The entire book is a puzzle. You're thinking, what is true and what is real? Of course, there's clues all the way through. But as you read through, you know that Billy can't travel through time, nor did he get abducted by aliens. Of course he can't, and of course he didn't get abducted by aliens, because like I say, it's not science fiction. But then, all the way through, you're thinking, why does he believe that he can do this? Why does he see the war in this way? And why does he do this? Or why is he thinking this way? Or why is his consciousness skipping throughout time in this way? And the answers of this book are provided at the very end of the book. That whole section where he is in the where he goes to New York answers all of those questions. If it isn't clear by the end of that section, you're an idiot. If you don't know what this is here as well, because there's lots of things that happen later than this. He talks about him, you know, going to Chicago and the way he's died and stuff like that. And you're like, that is not time travel. That is fiction. That is only happening in the deluded mind of someone who is, you know, who has had brain damage. He's got post-traumatic stress from the end of the Second World War, the, you know, his experiences in the Second World War. He's also got post-traumatic stress because he's grieving because his wife has just died, and he's been in a mental hospital before, and then he was in this, you know, in a coma for a long time and some kind of locked-in state as well, like that. You know, we know all of these different things going on in his mind. We know what's going on, but it's all in his mind. The things that happen after his trip to New York are patently false from an objective point of view because they're outside of the scope of the novel. They take place after the not the time when this novel was written as outlined by the narrator. He, like I say, Chicago was bombed. That didn't happen in the real world because it's after the book. It didn't happen. And the way that Chicago was bombed is a replaying in Billy Pilgrim's delusional mind about what happened to Dresden. It says the United States was balkanized. It split into states to make sure that it doesn't take part in any world wars. It doesn't start any world wars. That isn't what happened in America. That's what happened in Germany. Germany was split up into different sections. It was split up into a French sector, an American sector, a British sector, and a Russian sector. And so was Berlin itself. And that was split up so it couldn't start any more world wars, and it was just administrated by different powers as well. It didn't happen. Billy was not a superstar, you know, with best-selling books and doing sell-out stadium lecture tours and stuff. That didn't happen to him. That happened after the events of the end of the book. Nor was he killed in the way that he was. He says, oh, I lived through my own death. I know how I'm going to die. How was he killed? He's killed by a laser gun. That isn't what happens. That's pure science fiction influenced by the book that he's reading at the end of this book, which is all science fiction by Kilgore Trout. He isn't killed by a laser gun. That's his delusion. Everything that happens after his trip to New York, where he gets kicked out of the radio station, is a delusional part of the future. The time travel and the alien abduction in his past, you know, they're also ruled out. That didn't happen as well. You know, there aren't clues to this not actually happening. There are like these massive, like, signposts throughout the book. So he gets abducted by aliens. What are the words that he gets said to him when he's abducted by aliens? He goes, well, why me? And they say, well, why you? Why anything? And that is exactly the same words that the German says to him when he is captured at the beginning of the book, when he becomes a prisoner of war for the first time. His alien abduction is a replaying in his mind about the abduction by the Germans as well, like that. And also the flight to the Tralfamador is based on a novel that he reads at the end of the book by Kilgore Trout. The time travel part of it is probably there too as well. His sexual partner, when he gets to Tralfamador, again, it's right there at the end of the book. I can just give that away. But of course, that is pure wish fulfillment, fantasy fulfillment. And we know that she is not, you know, that really didn't happen to her because we're told what actually happened to her by what he reads in this pornography shop at the end of the book. Outside of his compound, when he's out, when he's on Tralfamador, he says outside of it, it's all pure cyanide. I couldn't leave my little compound because outside I'd be dead. That isn't actually what was happening. That is all in his mind. It's a delusion, all based on, you know, it mirrors the actual slaughterhouse, the freezer of the slaughterhouse when he's underground during the bombardment of Dresden. If he went outside, he couldn't go outside because pure death was outside this place. He's just replaying the actual things that did happen to him in his mind. And then, of course, you get the parts which are actually true, which are that all the time, every single time, when somebody else in the narrative is actually there with him, when he's, you know, when somebody else observes what Billy Pilgrim does, that is actually the truth. That is actually what's happening. They can't observe him subjectively going through time because that didn't happen. That's all a part of his brain damage and his delusion later on, and with him trying to make sense of all the experiences in his life, what he's gone through. But he doesn't do any of that. He's completely passive. And the time travel itself is a way of him rationalizing his completely passive nature and his shell shock and his post-traumatic stress and the reason why he married a, you know, someone who's fat and unattractive just for money afterwards, you know. He's that's all post hoc rationalization by a deluded mind, a brain damaged, deluded, post-traumatic stress grieving mind that he has when he's in the hospital at the end of the book. Now, again, I haven't, maybe I have just spoiled the book, but that's really for people who have read it. Maybe I should have said, skip ahead 5 minutes as I completely dissect the book and say actually what's happening here. But I can't read this. And it isn't just the one-star reviews. I read 5-star reviews for saying, oh, I don't know if it's meant to be real or not. It's like, no, it's clear. The whole thing was a puzzle, but it's all solved by the end. This is the main narrative arc about what Billy Pilgrim, what's going on in his head subjectively and why he's thinking this way, why he sees time in this way, why he's looking at this way. This is his one science fictional idea, which is like, you know, about living life and going through all this kind of stuff. You're not quite sure how much is stolen from Kilgore Trout or how much is stolen, you know, from these other influences as he's going through. But this idea of seeing life all at one point is there as well. Anyway, moving on to another review that I went, it goes 2-star reviews. There's a few of these, actually, not just 2-star reviews, 4-star reviews, 5-star reviews. Somebody goes, okay, I get your mind point, war is bad. And then another one says, this short novel is of 187 pages, has little to say. War is bad. Killing is bad. Duh. Another review says, the great theme here, war sucks, has been told 50 billion times before in 50 billion more effective ways. Now, if you think that this book is saying war is bad, duh, and that's it, I think you've missed the point a bit. This book is not about that. Well, it is about that. But the narrator at the beginning sums up his view of war is bad, killing is bad, duh, or war sucks, duh, or war is hell, duh, that kind of view. That he says that himself in the first chapter. He says, he said the Children's Crusade, you know, that was just a minor, more insane part of a much bigger insane thing, which was the larger, things like that. War is bad. War sucks, you know. They're not even interesting themes to Kurt Vonnegut in the end, because they are to him self-evident and obvious in a way that it's just like, yeah, duh. Like this, he says, okay, I said to my son, I've told my son, he says something like, I've told my sons that in no circumstance are they to take part in a massacre or any, like, and they're not allowed to work for a company which makes machines that make massacres possible, or any news of a massacre of their enemies. It's not meant to make them feel good. It's not meant to make them feel satisfied. You know, that's right there in chapter one. At one point he says, I'm going to write an anti-war book, and his friend, who may or may not have said this, because I'm not sure if this first chapter is fictional or not, he says, you might as well write an anti-glacier book. It's like, yeah, of course wars are going to happen, and they're inevitable in that way, and they're really bad. We know they're bad because, you know, duh, war is bad, killing is bad. And so people seem to think, or maybe I don't understand, like for me, this book is not an anti-war book. Of course it is an anti-war book in some ways, but it's not a book about war itself and about how bad it is. It's much more about death and about free will and about fate and all these other kind of things which are inevitable. You know, like, war is inevitable. It's anti, you know, it's an anti-glacier book, but there's so much other stuff going on here as well. Someone else says, this novel seems to revel in the fact that even though it is simple, it is really about the big ideas. Look at me, just mentioning those ideas over and over again without examining them is not enough. So I disagree with that, because I think this actually examines some very big ideas, and it's not just look at me, but I think the biggest idea is death, and that death is unavoidable, and it's right there in the spotlight. Like I say, there's this line, and so it goes, there's this refrain repeated every time that death is mentioned. He says, and so it goes, because that's what how the Tralfamadorians see it. It's like, yeah, everyone's going to die, and we know they're going to die, we even know how we're going to die, because we see all of time at once. And so when death happens, it's just like, oh, and so it goes at the end of the universe, and so it goes, and this person dies, and so it goes, this ant dies, and so it goes, 50,000 people die in the firebombing of Dresden, and so it goes, like that. But like, by bringing attention to it, it really does make it big. You see so much fiction where people die, and it's just like, oh yeah, this person dies, and this person dies, and you become numb to it. But this is saying that you can't become numb to it, and it's saying, face your own death, face your own inevitable fate, and what are you going to do about that? Can you change it? No, you can't change it. So how are you going to go about, you know, you're doing this? Some other review says, I copied this into my notes as well. It says, the point I got is this. No sense in trying to change anything. Things are going to happen the way they're going to happen, and nothing is going to change them. But again, they're missing that point as well. Twice in this book, there's the prayer of serenity is mentioned. One, you know, it's the one that goes, Lord, give me, you know, strength to get through the things I can't change, and the strength to change the things I can change, or whatever it is, and the wisdom to know which things I can change, or something like that. You know, I totally, you know, murdered that prayer of serenity, but it's mentioned twice in the book, and it is really about what things can we change, what things can't we change, and what things, you know, should we, you know, or do we? And it's knowing the difference between the two of them. War. Anti-glacier book, we can't change war. Wars are going to happen. It's very difficult to do that. However, this book isn't about war being bad. It's about the massacre being bad and about death being unavoidable. However, we can change different things. I'm just saying this is one of the themes that I get out of it. Now, Billy Pilgrim goes through life in a completely passive way, and he, you know, rationalizes his complete passive lifestyle by saying, oh yeah, well, all life happens and fate doesn't exist and things like that. Now, personally, I do believe that there's no such thing as, you know, the ghost in the machine or the god in the machine which gives us free will. I think that everything that I do is predetermined, but, you know, because it's just going on in my head. And if it isn't predetermined, it's going on, you know, determined by some kind of, you know, the quantum tubules in the brain, like Robert J. Sawyer talks about, which I can't control anyway because it's quantum and it's completely unpredictable in that way too. However, I'm not quite sure, I'm not convinced of all these different ways of looking at free will, but I don't think, personally, that free will exists. However, I can't live my life, I can't, you know, have the attitude of saying anything that happens, because that's not what my brain chemistry says. Subjectively, from, you know, from a solipsistic kind of point of view, I have to think that what I do does make sense, because that's what makes me happy. I can't live in a way that I think free will doesn't exist, even though I don't believe that free will exists, even though I'm a completely materialistic kind of, I have completely materialistic kind of outlook. I am, you know, at heart, someone who is a humanist and also someone who wants the best out of my life. And I know that my attitude for that comes from a completely non-free will kind of thing. But I know that I don't have free will, but my non-free will has got me to the point where I want to work against not having free will. And it's quite a strange paradox in my life that, again, if you listen back to, you know, episode number 100, where I talk a little bit about, you know, these different ideas, science fiction informing my personal philosophy, I have got to live as though in the future someone is going to write a book like Billy Pilgrim's about my life, and is going to skip through time and say, what's Luke doing here? What's Luke doing there? What's Luke doing here? How is he affecting life? How is he going to, you know, all that different kind of stuff. But I know free will doesn't exist, but that doesn't make me change anymore, because subjectively I can't live as that way. So it's, again, maybe I'm being a bit wishy-washy here, but the point isn't that there's no point in trying to change anything, and death is good and death is fine, and everyone who died in Dresden, yeah, that's okay, just let it happen, no problem at all. No, there is a problem about doing that. Don't partake in any massacres, don't work for people who partake in massacres. There's lots of stuff going on. There are things we can change, there are things we can't change, and we've got to work towards either way. The Tralfamadorian saying, oh, Darwin is your biggest hero because he says there's a point in death, and that's the betterment of the species. It's like, well, that's okay, I guess, but, you know, that's not what I think, you know, Kurt Vonnegut is trying to say with this book. What he is trying to say is different, but the main point of this book is him saying death is inevitable, you will die, I'm going to bring attention to it in the way that I can by me, like, telling the story of telling a story of what I went through, the kind of things that I went through and other people went through in the Second World War, when we were the victims. We weren't even the people carrying out the massacre, and yet we have to deal with it, and the people who dealt with it and things like that. So again, that's all there in the book too. What else did I write down here in my notes? Death is the center of it all as well, but, you know, not in a bad way. It is of course a, you know, dark comedy, you know, black comedy. Again, so someone says, you can't read Slaughterhouse-Five and not feel the loathing that the author had for women. Female characters are viewed by the narrator the way a 12-year-old boy might treat them at his worst. And I'm thinking, wait a second, did you miss the point that the narrator in this book is Kurt Vonnegut? But even that is probably a fictionalized narrator, even though he says, oh, this is me, and this is me, and this is me. And then the rest of the book is told by the point of views of Billy Pilgrim, who, you know, but it's told from his point of view after he was in a plane accident and had massive brain damage and, you know, had a wife that he was trying to justify because she was unattractive and fat, you know, who had just died, and he was trying to make sense of that, you know, and he had post-traumatic stress and all these different things, you know, massively delusional guy. And the way that he views women, and you're thinking that's what the author viewed women as? It's like, come on, get a clue. Another book, so it goes 4 stars, this review, a 4-star review, it says, it goes, this book has no plot, neither does life, it has no character development. And I'm like, what? This book has plot, it has character development, what are you talking about? However, it's told from the point of view of Billy at the end of his story, like, he can already see the whole story at the same time, but there is a story there, but again, it's only explained in those last, in that last chapter and things like that, and his whole character development is also explained in that last chapter. You think there's, you might think there's no character development, but again, just read that last 2 chapters again. Seriously, just read them again and you'll understand the whole book, or maybe just listen to my explanation a little bit before and you'll be able to understand what the whole book is driving at there as well. So anyway, there's a bit of a reaction. Hopefully I've talked a little bit about the themes there and about my what I liked about this book and about what you can do with science fiction and different things like that, even in a non-science fiction book. Even though, no, actually, I say this book is science fiction because it does talk about science fiction elements, but it's sort of like meta science fiction in the same way that it's meta fiction. It is fiction about fiction and fiction about the writing of fiction. And, you know, it's also meta kind of philosophy because it is about somebody's, you know, journey. And also, I think it's sort of like meta science fiction because it is fiction about science fiction rather than science fiction itself, which, again, very interesting way to do it. So my conclusion, I'm going to give this book 5 stars. And you may think, wow, 5 stars, that's a high rating. Yep, because I think it was really, really good. Again, probably made better by, you know, not in any way made worse by the narration by Ethan Hawke, but I think it's a really great narration of a fantastic book, and it has everything really that I want in a book in science fiction book as well. I really love non-linear structure, and I really like fiction about something that's happened to somebody and then they're trying to get over it. I much prefer that. I much prefer fiction about something happening in someone's past and then them trying to get past it and try and get over it and trying to work it into their life. If it's just fiction about somebody doing something good or doing something big or doing something heroic, yeah, that's interesting, but I really want to see what happens afterwards. Afterwards too. And like I said, non-linear structure and what else? Oh yeah, also the idea, all the great ideas that how you can bring the ideas of science fiction and talk about life and death and war and all these big themes, and the way that science fiction allows you to talk about these things in a way that you can't do without those science fiction ideas. And like I say, even though this book isn't a science fiction book, it has that angle to it as well, which I really love. And there's probably a reason why the other book that I gave five, the only other book that I've ever given 5 stars to on the Science Fiction Book Review podcast is Use of Weapons by Ian M. Banks. And again, you've got a non-linear structure, you've got somebody who's gone through some terrible experience and is trying to live with it and is trying to rationalize it into their lives and trying to move on and trying to become, you know, do that. And you've got, of course, the science fictional elements there as well, and reflecting on life and death and all these other things too. And so, yeah, I think that's, this, me liking this book is pretty much a gimme. And of course, my own fiction as well. When I wrote my own first science fiction novel, and actually, let me put it this way, the first time I completed my own science fiction novel, it has these elements in there as well. Because why would I write about anything else? Because that's what I love about science fiction. So I put all of those things that I love about science fiction into my first novel, Minding Tomorrow. It's told in a non-linear structure. It's got, you know, something's happened in this guy's past and he's trying to get through it and he's trying to make sense of life with these, all these life experiences that he keeps going through. And of course it talks about life in ways that you can do with science fiction. I don't want to give too much about it away, but it's all there as well. I'm not saying that my novel is anywhere close to this one and of close to close to Use of Weapons by Ian M. Banks, but if I'm going to write a novel, I don't see any reason why I would aim for anything less, and that's what I do. You know, Minding Tomorrow, there's actually, I talk about personal responsibility, and I talk about the different things from a science fiction point of view, but it's very explicitly not about war and violence and stuff like that. There's only 2 acts of violence in the entire novel, and I made it very clear that neither of them are actually explained. You've got to live with them, you've got to deal with them, but there's 2 acts of violence. One of them just foreshadows the other, but neither of them are explained. However, in the other, my second novel actually, which follows that up, is called Combat. And there's a reason why it's called Combat, is because it really is about post-traumatic stress and about somebody being involved in killing people and about having to get over that kind of stuff too. And the third novel actually that I'm writing at the moment for National Novel Writing Month continues more in the vein of the first novel, more non-linear, even though that second book, Combat, is non-linear too. Again, it goes back to the point of view of the main character from the first novel, and again talks about once you understand some more reasons about sort of going on and some ultimate Maybe not ultimate, but the way that that story is going to play out as well. Again, not that my books are as good as that, but if I'm going to write a book, why would I write a book? Why would I write anything less than I think is going to be a 5-star book? And to make it a 5-star book, to make it most enjoyable for me, it has to have those elements in there. Well, it doesn't have to have, but it just so happens that the books that I enjoy most do have those elements in there too. So, so that's it. 5-star book. Pretty good, eh? Next book I'm going to read, or I'm actually started already, is called Flood by Stephen Baxter, because I was trying to read The Time Ships, but it was actually a paper book and I was really struggling to get through it. I also have The Hunger Games by, again, I can't remember who wrote that. Susan Collins, I think it is, who wrote that. I have that there as well on my iPod, so I'm started Flood as well. I'm probably going to get to Hunger Games soon too. So if you've got any other suggestions of books that I should be reading, email me, luke@juggler.net, and any feedback at all. There's different ways that you can give me feedback. Of course, email is a good way. I'll reply to every email that I get. Also, if you just want to talk and discuss this, go on to goodreads.com and comment on the review that I did of this book on goodreads.com, which is actually just saying check out this podcast review, but you can find it there as well, goodreads.com/Luke Burridge. And also there's a SFBRP listener group as well. If you want to discuss things with other people, you can do it through goodreads.com. Become my friend on there. Also, I can follow what you're reading how you like this book. Actually, let me check this out. I have the page open here, goodreads.com, about Slaughterhouse-Five. This has been read by 61 other of my friends have read this, and it's averages a 4.02. So Eric, per Eric Andre, 5 stars. Anthony, 5-star. Keith Jones, 5 stars. Let's say it has Graham Bootle, 2 stars. What are you thinking, Graham? Listen to this review. You'll enjoy this book a lot more. What else have we got here? Sean O'Hara, 1 star. What are you doing, guys? Jay Days rated it 2 stars. Let me reply to this. He goes, I really enjoyed the first chapter of this Kurt Vonnegut's most famous book, where he talks about how difficult the book was to write. Did he really write that? I think that's actually fiction about Kurt Vonnegut writing about how this was a difficult book to write. I think he came up with the idea and probably was quite easy to write. Vonnegut's voice, his persona, is extremely engageful, rueful, cutting. I found the rest of the book a letdown. His most famous phrase repeated ad nauseum. So it goes. I found annoying, self-dramatizing, and then as it was repeated more and more, I don't know, it became like music. I might pick up essays by Vonnegut, but I doubt I would try another novel. Jay, you're an idiot. Might as well just say that there. Tamer, 1 star. What are you thinking? Most people are like 3, 4, 5 stars, though. Anyway, yeah, so I can actually see what you're thinking about books that I'm reading, and you can keep up with my things like that. Another thing that you can do is follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurge on Twitter. And finally, check out my website, which is lukeburge.com. There you can find my blog, which I put up lots of different stuff. Photos, videos, movies, music, all my other things, science fiction book review podcast related, goes all onto that blog there. And also you can find my fiction there as well, lukeburge.com/fiction.html. you can find my own writing and give it a read, and if you like it, email me about it too. That'd be great. Thanks. Anyway, thanks for listening. I think I've gone on, how long have I gone on here? Let's go back here. Oh, 55 minutes. It's been a long one, but I think hopefully a good one. And so check out Kurt Vonnegut. Don't know what the film's like, never seen it, and I'll probably get on to some other Vonnegut books next year as well. I've got lots of other books that I need to read too, and see if I enjoy it quite as much as Slaughterhouse-Five. Like I say, I did read it with the book Galapagos, but it was about these guys who went there, and it was told from the point of view of the dead friend who was watching it from the... But it was so long ago, I can't really remember much about it. But I obviously didn't enjoy it as much as Slaughterhouse-Five, because if I'd have did, I'd probably have read other books by Kurt Vonnegut. So I'll probably check out that book again, maybe some other books too. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.